it could push to a place where, if we call his bluff, he's pushing to a place where he's going to hurt himself, and then now it's a way different ball game.
And that's
why would
I'm
that happen
too?
At I mean, school and not at home?
Why would he push him?
Why would I call his bluff all the time at home? It's not happening.
I mean, that's at home. There's no demands. I mean, there he does some stuff around the house, I'm sure, from what he says. But isn't it like he's at home? He's in his
it's
happy
the freaking
place.
Weekend. And this is another. This is what I would say too.
Hey, did you know you can actually earn BACBCUs if you're listening to this episode? If you'd like to learn more, including about our Behavior Analyst Certification Board CEUs, that is continuing education units for people that hold the credentials by the BACB, you can go to explanatoryfiction.com and find this episode. Welcome to Explanatory Fiction. It's very important that you know how this podcast is structured. We've randomly generated this case. The variables are entirely fictional. That's right, because with the power of math and science, you can actually do these things now. In fact, the name Trevor Woodrow was randomly generated too. And the episode art, you guessed it, also made by artificial intelligence. But the best part is our team is real and the conversations that ensue are designed as a game that you get to play along with us. In each episode, we have one person that is evaluating the case from a clinical decision-making model, and the others are accomplices of mine who are trying to stump the analyst. Our challenge to you is, can you figure out a possible treatment model before us? Here we go. Trevor Woodrow is a 14-year-old ninth grader. He's in high school. He's a student diagnosed with emotional behavioral disorder and autism spectrum disorder, the known history of domestic violence from his father when he was young. His mother raises him on her own, and he was recently placed in a special education classroom to receive help for two different behavior problems. The first is vocal stereotypy, which occurs typically in the form of constant narrations of his actions and the actions of others occurring around him. The second is threats of self-harm and suicidal ideation that occur if his behavior escalates. He has a one-on-one paraprofessional assigned to him in the classroom, whose name is Chris, who is overseen by the teacher, Amy, and the school social worker, Percy, is a very active person involved in the case as well due to the suicidal ideation and threats of self-harm. He does not currently receive behavioral supports, but you've been asked to come in and evaluate the case and assess the need for potential services. So, Dimitri, this afternoon, you will have an admin meeting with the entire team, including mom. So we'll conclude that after you have some time to understand things a little bit with Chris, Percy, and Amy.
Hey, man, I'm Percy. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you, Percy. Well, how can I help you today? So tell me what's going on.
Well, mostly we're here to talk about Trevor and kind of his increasing behaviors. And I'm mostly involved because suicidal ideation is something that comes up when he's escalated. And we tend to work together a lot when that's coming up.
Yeah, I saw the suicidal ideation on the request for services. And that definitely took me back. We're definitely going to talk about that quite a bit. If you don't mind, though, before we get to that, would you just give me a general rundown of kind of what's going on with him from your point of view?
Sure. Well, there's a couple things about Trevor. One is he just kind of narrates. There's no really filter about internal thought versus external thought. He's labeling kind of everything happening around him to the extent that it's not really conducive for the gen ed setting.
So there's no internal monologue, or it's more just like compulsory, just kind of rigid points being like spoken out loud, almost just kind of like
it's just more
tack,
just
tack,
like
tack, 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 instead of like actually like, oh, we're doing this and then we're doing that, and like providing like some fluid sequential description of what's happening.
It's kind of like the narrator voice of what he's doing, and then also if the focus shifts, it can be narrating or talking to about people around as well.
Okay, so he's literally like breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience.
Yeah. Okay. So it is just a pretty constant stream. And then a lot of the content of what ends up coming up can be kind of that darker content. Like I said, suicidal ideation, threatening self-harm when he's escalated. So mostly we're just trying to avoid that, how far that can go, because that becomes, you know, CPS things, that becomes strain with the family, and we're mostly just trying to keep it calm
and have him account. CPS isn't involved.
Yeah, the suicidal ideation piece is something where, I mean, I'm a mandated reporter.
I guess let's just walk through that then, and kind of let's talk about it. So have you conducted a risk assessment?
He has done risk assessments, and okay. I've actually worked with some higher trauma guys previously at different positions, so I've used some good tools too. His self-reporting does put him in a,
What are the findings?
He there is some substantial risk just from his self-reporting, and actually he has a history of domestic violence from his dad, who's not in the picture. So there's some trauma-informed pieces as well, where we're just we try to enable that positivity and potentially not dig too deep in this setting necessarily, because we're not trying to poke kind of that suicidal bear, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I guess what I'm what I'm trying to assess is the immediacy of the danger or risk. So does he have means, opportunity, access, motivation? Does he express a particular way he would hurt himself?
I mean, he is saying, I'm going to kill himself. I'm not really asking him how he's going to, I don't want to dig into how expressing he's going to, he can be a little bit colorful with it, but it is typically more so just, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going to hurt myself. This needs to end. He doesn't get too picturesque with it.
But I mean, there's sometimes you just be like, I'm going to shoot myself in the face. I'm going to cut myself with a knife. I'm going to slit my wrists. Like, there's some degree of specificity usually in terms of how people, especially if it's like ongoing, continuous, and it's used in the context of whatever self-narration that you're describing. So that's why I'm just asking if he does give specifics, or it's just more of an exclamation of self-harm.
It tends to be more of that exclamation. There's even a little bit of reminiscence of, he's into like video games, but not really Call of Duty and stuff. And he listens to metal, which we connect on, because I used to be a System of a Down guy too. So while it's not too picturesque, there is some familiar phrases he'll pop into a little bit. That I imagine are just lyrics from songs. Lyrics.
So you think it's scripting lyrics? He's not necessarily.
I haven't done the research to see what it's from or what the intent is, okay. But there are some patterns that come up with what he's saying.
Does he have actual attempts in the past, or always just verbal reports?
I mean, at school, we're typically trying to keep it. I'm pretty on call for him, so I'm jumping in early. There has been like hospitalization before from.
Okay. So so when you say hospitalization, was that in response to verbal threats of it, or was it an actual failed attempt?
It was, we were unsuccessful at de-escalating him while he was here, and he was not going to be safe going home in the state that he was.
Okay. I need you to be a little more specific for me. That I understand that unsafe could mean a lot of things. So, and I know this is an uncomfortable topic, and I'm sure. Really sorry to feel like I'm sounding so matter of fact about it or being dismissive. I promise you I'm not. I'm taking it very seriously. For me, part of what's really helpful to kind of help give an assessment of what's going on is to really dig into the nature of the vocalizations, the nature of the threats, the contextual variables, the simple environmental cues that he might be referring to, or factors that might be influencing things. And to do that, I have to really kind of dig into not just the words in total that he's saying, but also maybe some of the implications and maybe some of the subtle nuance that he may be expressing to help determine maybe some causal factors too. Maybe we can start figuring out the why of this. And that's really why I'm asking you the questions I'm asking. So I don't mean to kind of put you in a tough bind here. So just to rewind now, when you say that he was going to be unsafe, now with me saying all that,
sure,
could you be a little more specific by what does it mean that he would be unsafe? Like, you were in fear that he was actually going to go home or in some way follow through when he wasn't around you?
Yeah.
And the parent had confirmed that that was a fear of theirs or a thing that they'd happened in the past?
Usually we're able to calm him down when he gets to this point. This was one where it was later in the day, and okay. He was really amped up and his transportation was there. School's done. So we're trying to calm him down. He's not calming down. I know mom is a single parent, so I wasn't 100% sure, certain she was going to be there when he got home. And then he said, I'm going to go home and I'm going to cut myself.
Okay. At that point, you kind of called 911 and just in response to that,
yep.
Due to the, like, what seemed like an immediate, absolutely reasonable
and totally valid threat, especially with this repeated pattern of this kind of ideation and with us not having adequate time to get him to a calm space, that that's the best we could do in that moment.
Has mom ever reported actual attempts, though, or only vocal threats, verbal threats?
There's kind of some ambiguity as they each tell me what things are. So Trevor will kind of tell me that things happened, and then mom will say that that didn't happen, and they kind of have different perspectives. So she hasn't seen any actual harm or any valid attempts, but he'll come in and he'll say, I did this. Well, of course, yeah, mom wouldn't tell you. And it's just kind of trying to find that balance while giving his words some validity while also taking the threat serious enough, because it keeps happening, and he's a kind of depressed teenager, man.
Did the doctors report, or has there ever been any observations of actual marks on his body or cutting of any kind or anything like that, where bruising or just excessive scratching or wounds or just anything that would indicate a pattern of physical follow through?
No, we have not seen that necessarily, like fresh wounds, bruises, any of that. And like I used to do body charts, intake, outtake every day. Like I understand, sure, yeah, what we're looking for, and okay. I did not see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So at least for the time being. And then is mom have everything, since he did mention the idea of cutting himself? Does mom keep sharp objects out of reach, locked away, so he doesn't have direct access to them at home?
We've recommended that. And then, I mean, I know CPS has gone there, but I don't know if anything meaningful has actually happened. She doesn't seem as concerned with the language that he's saying, kind of that two different stories coming her way. And she doesn't see the way we see it. But
is it one of those scenarios where she's kind of heard him threaten and talk about it so much for so long, it almost seems like she's desensitized and habituated to it?
Oh yeah, like that's just Trevor to her. That's like
verbal junk.
That's it. That's Trevor to her. That's everything. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Is there a possibility that, and again, I don't want to diminish, you know, the reality of self-harm or anything like that, but given, well, I guess before I say this, how long has he been expressing these kinds of vocalizations? Like, how long has there been ideation or just even expressions of self-harm?
Well, this is his first year at this school. So I saw some things on his paperwork about it coming up previously, but I didn't get a chance to talk to his old teachers. We've seen it pretty much the whole time he's been here.
Okay. Does he engage in, how do I put this delicately? Does he have some trustworthiness issues at times? Like, does he exaggerate, engage in hyperbole? Does he kind of misdirect? Does he withhold when he tells a story, for example? Are there lies of omission where he kind of only tells his side but doesn't necessarily tell all the explicit details of a situation that might kind of outline the facts from multiple parties' perspectives? Like, does he malinger in your sessions with him?
I think I'm understanding what you're saying. So he'll say things that like that mom is saying, and he'll report what other adults are saying and telling him to do and what's happened to him. And then when I speak to those adults directly, it does not line up. So he is intentional with his language about other people's motivations and those perspectives. And
would
and
you characterize it as slight manipulation
of just of me,
of the perception that one would take from a situation, not you explicitly, but you know, the proverbial you as conversational partner, whoever that may be, fit X.
You know, it might be a blurry line between self-manipulation and kind of that self-aggrandizing high schooler ninth grade perspective. Their right, view yeah. is, yeah.
You talking know, smack it, and just talking big and just kind of like talking.
So it's hard to find where that line is. And you don't really want to necessarily call them on those lies and break the trust when you're working so hard to like be that individual that can talk the person down, get them calm. And we've established that rapport. So there's pieces that I just, you know, you yes and it. It's improv, and you get them to sure. the place where it's calm, because if they fixate, then it doesn't, we don't get to that calmer space.
What formal diagnoses does he have?
Emotional behavior disorder and autism.
Okay. EBD. Is that an educational classification, or is that like a NOS from the DSM?
That's from a psych eval. He is attending on the autism. He's attending under his autism diagnosis and has the behavior goals and things about by that. But we acknowledge that there's a trauma history, a history of that domestic violence. And then it's a broadly labeled emotional behavior disorder.
Okay. All right. Is he on any particular medications?
Okay. No, he's not currently on any medications.
All right. you said that mom pretty much doesn't express overt concern over those threats, correct? Just to reiterate.
No, yeah, she's pretty used to it and attributes it to being kind of a personality trait.
Okay. What's the reaction like when he starts making these threats and like what's the context in which they happen? Because if he's just, because here's what I'm visualizing. I'm visualizing a kid that's kind of going about his day and he's just doing, you know, the in a world, only he's living in the movie and he's that voice kind of talking over his own movie. And then I just imagine a situation or scenario that may not be preferred or problematic to him or avoid or a thing he wants to avoid or a boring situation. I'm trying to place, and then something changes and then it switches from that in a world voice describing his fun time or his life to I'm going to hurt myself. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that to me. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this to me. That's what I'm imagining. How close am I to what I'm describing?
You're not too far off. I don't see as much of a distinct switch kind of like you're talking about where we've got the deep velvety voice that then turns into me yeah. talking about what's going on in his life.
That was creative license on my part. So I'm just trying to get a handle over it.
It's good to be able to pull off a couple of gigs. I'm usually entering when we are already seeing suicidal ideation in the classroom.
So you're coming in when it's already happened. What have the teachers or paras reported the context where those vocalizations happen? Those expressions happen.
There is some documentation of this that might be something to talk to them about because there's a little bit of variety in it. When I enter, I'm usually basically full focus on him. When it starts happening, I'm basically there. Just because of that's part of the policy right now, just because of the nature of it. And so teacher will shoot me a text. I'm there popping in and trying to talk on the coping skills and mindfulness things that we keep practicing and that we're working on.
Cool. So, Percy, you've been so detailed and helpful in me trying to understand what's going on here. Oh, just before we're done here, what's your background? What kind of approach do you like to take in those sessions? Well, you mentioned mindfulness, and that's interesting. What kind of mindfulness approaches do you use or with the students or your clients, your patients?
My background comes from kind of more trauma, and we don't have as much time to work on as much, I guess, like skill gain for those pieces there. But we practice these kinds of exercises that we model and we try to help get to calm. So I like that the AIM curriculum that I identify, move and. You know, we work on some trauma-informed workbooks and things about how you can kind of filter the filter approach things for like trying to block out some of the verbal outburst pieces. So we're mixing a few different curriculums right now because this is such a wide problem that manifests in a few different ways.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's great. That's supposed to be a really popular and quality curriculum. I'll tell you what. I think it would be really helpful if I could get maybe the teacher's perspective and maybe the paras too, since they could maybe fill in some of the gaps of like what's happening in the immediate time. Mm-hmm. Is there any way that I can chat them up?
Yeah, I can walk you over and I'll be around too if you need to touch base later.
Really appreciate the world meeting. You're fantastic. Yeah, I really can't wait to wrap this up later with you in the room.
Sweet. Thanks, man.
Stupendous.
Hey, are you Dimitri?
Yeah, hi. How's it going? Nice to meet you.
I'm doing all right. I'm Chris. I'm the paraprofessional who works
awesome,
with
Chris.
Trevor.
Fantastic, Chris. Yeah, it's great. Absolutely. So is the teacher available to talk with us too right now so we can just like get the two of you, or is she got to watch the room?
She's got the class right now. She might come in like halfway through our talk.
Okay, all right.
We're trying to get a sub in there.
Okay, no problem. Well, I'll tell you what, Chris, I had a chance to talk with Percy and he kind of gave me a general rundown from his perspective of what's going on. And he seemed to express a lot of concern about Trevor's suicidal ideation and what he describes. Oh, yeah. And I'm trying to get a handle on not how seriously we need to take it, but how likely it is he's actually going to follow through with something. So that will really dictate kind of what my suggestions are here, at least in the immediate timeline and in school. So go ahead. Sorry.
As a paraprofessional, it's the intensity of it is really hard to witness.
So tell me a little bit about that. What do you mean by intensity of it?
I mean, it's a 14-year-old kid talking about self-harm.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I haven't been in this field long, 10 months. 8 of those months I've been with Trevor. I feel I've really gotten to know him. It hurts my heart to kind of see him talk the way that he does. So, I mean, most of our day, one of the BCBAs from the school recommended non-contingent reinforcement. Okay. In terms of talking to him throughout the day. It kind of stops his narration from pivoting to inappropriate directions. I can kind of keep it on common interests and that sort of thing. With me in the classroom, if I'm able to commit all my time to him, we're usually fine.
That's interesting. So what do you mean by that? You mean that if you guys are hanging out, talking about, when you say dedicate all your time to him, what exactly does that mean?
There's me, one other paraprofessional, and the lead teacher in the classroom. There's about 11 kids in the classroom, and Trevor's basically my one-on-one.
So about 1-4, 1-4, 1.3.5, but like you're one-on-one, and it's one-on-5.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Trevor definitely needs the most assistance.
So when you're with him, what are you guys doing when you are able to give him that undivided attention? What does that look like?
Talking about common interests. He likes Legend of Zelda. He plays Nintendo. He likes his 90s alternative. We talk Nirvana sometimes.
Nice.
Very
kid after my own heart.
Very rarely I've tried to kind of shift to school appropriate talk, like positive praise for completing his work. We're kind of talking about the book report that he's working on, but unless it's science class, that doesn't tend to really stick. He always kind of pivots back to those common interests. He is by far excelling the most in our class. He's pretty much on grade level, and his classroom is working on much more daily living skills, functional academics, that sort of thing. It's not really a concern to me that he's not getting his work done, because he seems to be keeping up fine.
Yeah,
as it is.
I want to go back to this common interest thing, if you don't mind. So when you say that if you pivot away from the common interest, that's usually when it starts. So he's saying, he's doing his little narration, because Percy described that he just, you know, likes to kind of to say out loud what he's thinking, like no internal monologue type scenario. And you guys are talking about, you know, the good old days, what I like to call them. All the good, cool stuff and fun stuff back when rock and roll still was alive. If you walk away from that or kind of pivot to something that's just more math, reading, any subject matter other than science-y, then it's like, I'm going to kill myself?
No, it's not that extreme, but he does kind of start to shut down. The way that he narrates his peers can also kind of escalate the peers sometimes. They really don't like when he talks about them, and he will do that very audibly.
Could you give me an example?
If a peer is working on a worksheet that's well below grade level, they'll kind of comment about it. If he's sees another kid,
what's he say about it? Is it description or is it descriptive or is it condescending?
It's descriptive in a condescending way.
So could you just be him for a second? And I don't mean to make fun of him. I'm trying to contextualize here. What are the words that he actually is using? What does the intonation look like? Because like in my mind, I'm trying to determine and distinguish what kind of social interaction is he actually facilitating and creating between the kind of words and the kind of intonation, the kind of interaction he's actually engaging in. So like the description is good in the broad space, but I mean, like, what does it actually sound like? Is it more like Stevie's over there working on his worksheet? Or is it Stevie's working over there on a worksheet for dumb kids? Those are two different comments, you know what I mean?
So not for dumb kids, but he'll say like, Billy's working on his second grade math and Billy is a high schooler.
I see. So he'll point out.
Billy's getting pissed off when Billy's starting to show some precursors to some of his more intense behaviors. So the other students kind of, he feeds off of that. He notices when he's kind of getting under his peer's skin, he kind of uses it in a pretty clever way to get us to come back to him and shut it down.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't? or anything that you think I really need to know from your point of view?
When we do try and get Trevor to do work in class, the discrepancy between what his peers are working on and what's assigned to him often kind of can lead to a bit of a tiff. He'll call it unfair.
Because he's working on grade level and they're not.
Absolutely.
Have you been part of any discussions about why he's in that room with those kids? Is it just the suicidal ideation?
Oh, no, it seems the talking. Like, he gets bullied. Okay. Anytime they've tried to do a push into a general ed classroom, he gets bullied beyond belief, and we get phone call after phone call from mom that he needs to be pushed back into a into the classroom, our classroom.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then anytime.
So really the reason is how disruptive it is that he's narrating out loud. That's the.
Absolutely.
Okay. And then the suicidal ideation is a behavior of severe, serious concern because he's obviously describing the possibility of hurting himself.
Yeah.
But in terms of the degree of disruption that it creates in the learning environment, it's the vocal, I don't want to call it stereotypy, but continual vocal expression. Okay. I'll tell you what. I think we'll circle back together when we have the meeting. I'd like to be able to catch Amy also before this is over. Do you mind swapping with her so I can just talk to her too?
Yeah, let me walk you for her.
Thank you. Appreciate it, man. Really helpful. Really helpful. Hi, Amy. How's it going?
Oh, hi. You're Dimitri?
Yes, yes. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Lovely. Thanks, Chris, for looking after the class while we chat.
Anytime.
So, Amy, I had a chance to chat with Percy and Chris. If you don't mind, what's going on?
I don't spend too much one-on-one time with Trevor, right? Chris is a godsend. Like, he spends a lot of time.
Seems like a sweet guy. Really cares, yeah.
Yeah, really cares and has built a really strong relationship with Trevor. And Trevor really trusts him and does really well in the classroom with Chris's support.
Wonderful. So what, from what you do know of the situation, what would you say is the thing that's going on here?
I mean, a lot of it's really beyond me, right?
I'm sorry. I missed that part. Would you say one more time?
A lot of it's really beyond me. I mean,
okay.
The suicidal ideation is something I haven't really dealt with before. You know, he's academically so talented. Right. He's doing things that his peers in this classroom might not
they can't contend
get
with.
To. Yeah. Well, you know, we're working on how to pay for groceries at the grocery store and creating a budget and managing your bank
functional
account.
Functional academics, functional life skills.
And he's like ready for algebra.
Yeah. So it's a little bit below his situation. Do you think that maybe that might be a cause of a lot of what's going on, though, is that that discrepancy between his peers and what he's doing, do you think that's feeding it or do you think it's something else?
Maybe. I mean, he doesn't really want to do the work that I'm giving him. That's really where he could be doing it, right?
So it's not like he wants to be doing the work. It's more like...
No, but he also doesn't want to be doing what they're doing.
The distinction and maybe that causes a little bit of embarrassment.
And the others recognize it too, right? Okay. They're seeing that he's hanging out with Chris, right? They're not really doing a ton of work. They're talking about Zelda and cool things, and I'm trying to get the others to work on their
school
work.
He's hanging out with his buddy, and they're doing their work.
Exactly. So it just doesn't feel like this classroom's really set up for Trevor, and I know he struggles in the other classrooms, but I don't really know how to help him myself.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you said that because that's one of the things that I'm thinking in my head is that I just not sure if this is the right fit for him. On the flip side, though, I definitely recognize that, and I think it's definitely a problem that his narration's so disruptive in more of a gen ed setting. So there's gotta be some kind of middle way we can set up. Huh?
It's not that disruptive in my class because Chris does such a great job supporting him that really the narration is very rarely a problem unless Chris needs to go help someone else or step out of the room.
And then it really hits 11.
Well, yeah. Or if the work is too much, then we start to see, and Chris isn't available, the suicidal talk is actually what's most disruptive and is the most concerning for
how do you guys react when he does? How do you guys react when he gets into that suicidal mode? So is it an immediate drop everything and attend to him and get Percy involved? Is it an immediate like, oh, we shouldn't, like, do you try to correct him and redirect him away from it? Like, what is the, what's the tactic right now?
Well, again, usually Chris isn't in the room to help kind of mediate that. That's when this is happening. And so I very quickly contact Percy. Percy comes, sweeps him out of the room. They go chill in his office for a little bit, work on whatever they do in there. And then he usually comes back when Chris is back.
I see.
And things are fine.
All right. Interesting. Well, is there anything that I should know from your perspective that I didn't ask, or any information that maybe would be, you think would be critical that I need to understand? No is an acceptable answer, by the way.
I don't think there's anything else. Like, I just know that some of this is getting back to the families of the other kids in the class, the students in the class, and, you know.
Is that creating disruption for you?
For sure. I mean, they're asking why there's someone in this classroom talking about cutting themselves, and you know, it's that's a really hard subject for me to tackle with the whole class to explain. Like, that's just a whole other mental health realm that I'm not
readily
prepared to teach. Yeah,
I hear you. That's fair. And you know what? I really appreciate you recognizing your scope. It's important to be honest about those things. Well, I'll tell you what, I feel like I was able to talk to everybody involved and get some information. So I think I'm going to go and kind of think about everything and put it all together. So, and then we'll have our, I think we have our meeting this afternoon, right?
Yeah. I probably will still be teaching, but you and Chris and Percy will meet. And if I'm able, I'll pop in.
Wonderful. Well, it was a really pleasure speaking with you, Amy, and hopefully our paths will cross sooner than later. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you.
As Dimitri leaves the classroom, he bumps into Percy.
Oh, hey Percy. What's up, man?
Hey,
just kept talking with Amy and Chris. It was
perfect. Great. Yeah. Hope that went well.
Yeah, it was really helpful, really informative.
So they told you kind of how he ends up coming to me, and we hang out in the room and get him back to calm.
Mm-hmm.
I did want to dig let you know a little bit more about some of my hesitations and what's going on, especially with the relationship with Mom. A big piece of this is the fact that we are calling CPS so much. So I feel like I'm losing that connection to home.
Well, you are a mandated reporter, so I don't think you should feel too much guilt about that, but
well, the time that he was not able to go home and we had him emergency removed, they forced a hospitalization on him for 3 days to be observed. And Mom kind of saw that as my doing, which I mean, I called, but she thought I overreacted, and there's still some haze in that relationship where we haven't really resolved that.
They would not have put him on a 72-hour hold if they didn't think he was in crisis. I mean, they would only really do that if they thought there was something serious going on. Because,
well, I mean, they see what I see.
Discharge almost immediately, despite what our perception is of things. So I would, I'm not sure. Are you just letting me know that there's a little bit of emotional charge going on because she maybe you're potentially in an adversarial situation now because of how she took it personally, or what are we talking about here exactly?
Yeah. And I mean, if I can get a little personal, I've been in this position for 2 years, and I don't want to be the social worker who cried wolf on this thing. Like, I am a mandated reporter. I'm going to follow through on it. But if you get a noisy parent who's talking to admin, I feel like this is a little bit of a unstable ground. So I felt like I don't want this to go on me because he and I calm down together constantly. And when he says he kills himself, like, hey, we're buds, man. We're friends. Like, I want you here. We're cool. Yeah. So it's just a really challenging balance. And I know that probably the next steps of this are going to be conversations with all of us. And I felt like that was some important context for you to have.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. Yeah.
So,
well, we go into that meeting, let me just reassure you here, man. My job is not to bus roll anybody or to point the fingers at anyone. I'm not here to do that. This isn't about assigning blame. This is about determining why is going on. Why does Trevor do what he does? Not whose fault it is that he does it. He's 14 years old. You know, 14 years is a long time to learn, acquire, and contact your environment in ways where a couple of years or even a year of anything that you may be doing did not create solely in any way, shape, or form the conditions of his behavior. So I can assure you that my point of view is that this is not any particular person's fault. This is just where we are today, and our job is to figure out why. So please know that I would never facilitate or sit in a meeting that I would even permit that to happen or be the agenda item. It's not how I believe that we should serve people and what the goal of this particular situation is. So that's good.
I really appreciate
you bringing that up to me, and I just want you to know that that's not what we're here to do.
I just want to make sure we're on the same page about CPS stuff when it comes up.
Yeah, for sure. And the CPS stuff, what I would say to you is that, like, I mean, just hearing everything, my gut reaction is that a lot of it is just, you know, I want what I want when I want it. I want attention, and I know when something I don't like is going to be happening, or I'm not getting the things that I want when I want them. If I really highlight this thing, everyone's going to drop everything, because that just happens to be, you know, one of those red lines that we as educators, and we just as helping professionals, want to be very acutely in tune to, because the last thing you would ever want is to have someone hurt themselves and or extinguish themselves on your watch because you chose to ignore the factors. So I understand the high wire act of these situations, and they are very difficult needles to thread. I think that just as some fresh eyes coming into the case, I think there's some ways that we can tackle that could strike the appropriate balance, at least for now. And then, you know, long term, you know, we make adjustments as things shift and as we get more and more information over time. And that's my head going into it. So, I mean, I hear you, and I think I'm ready to sit down and talk with everybody and like kind of paint a picture here. So
sure. Yeah. Let me get that.
Is you okay with that game plan going into it? I want to make sure that we're going into this, you know, as a united front too. I don't want you to feel like, the information you need to feel okay.
I think we're on the same page. I think I can try to get everyone together in the conference room if you want. Just one moment.
Percy, Chris, and Amy. Rebecca Woodrow has arrived. Here, please report to the office. Thank you.
Hi everybody, how are you all? Thank you for meeting with me about Trevor. I had a chance to kind of debrief and interview everybody, and Rebecca, I kind of got a snapshot from everyone's point of view. I really haven't had a chance to kind of get what your perception is of everything. So before I go into my recommendations, just real quick, just give me a quick, what's your point of view in terms of what's going on with Trevor?
I just think the school is not supporting him the way he needs to be supported. I don't know. These aren't issues we have at home. This is really, this is kind of impacting my day being at this meeting, and I don't really see why we're getting together.
I hear you. I can hear your frustration. So when you say you don't, just real quick though, before I go into this, so when you say you don't really see it, are you saying Trevor doesn't threaten to hurt himself or doesn't really narrate continuously at home, or it's just not a problem?
It's not a problem. He says things. I mean, it's who he is, right? He's been doing this for a long time.
He does do those things though. And how long has he made threats to himself? Like how long has he, when's the first time that ever started happening?
As soon as he kind of hit puberty, teenage years, you know, like
so would you say like, 10, 11 years old or 13?
12-ish maybe.
Okay, so it's been about 2 years since it started. So, okay, so, and middle school-ish, right? Sixth grade going to middle school kind of situation. Right?
Yeah. After, it's also around the time that his dad left.
Okay, so that there is kind of like an acute event there that kind of precipitated all these things too. And from what I understand, there was some trauma involved with dad. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, he'll talk about some stuff. It's not as bad as he makes it out to be. It's just being Trevor. It's not what I do.
Okay. And please forgive me if it sounds like I'm pushing you too hard here. I really need to pinpoint some of these items. When you say it's not so bad as he reports, as in like he exaggerates it and dad was just kind of like a tough parent, or like there was some physical stuff?
There was definitely some things that happened, and it was not good. But it wasn't, like, he tends to exaggerate it even beyond what it
was. Okay, so it was corporal punishment, or was there sexual behavior involved?
You know, he was just a really dad, you know? Wasn't kind to him, very punishing, wasn't kind in general, and then left.
All right, okay. I'll just leave it there then. I think that's enough for me to kind of get a snapshot here. Let me just ask you one final direct question, because you've kind of said this, but I want to be very clear over what you think. Are you concerned in any way, shape, or form that Trevor is going to hurt himself at all, follow through in any way, and has he ever tried to follow through around you in the past?
No, it really is something that we're just seeing.
So from your point of view, it's just him talking?
Yeah, it's just, okay. It's just Trevor.
Okay, all right, great. Then I think I'm ready to proceed with the rest of the meeting with everyone. Well, thanks for having me here. There's a lot going on and a lot of different suggestions that I can make. I have some recommendations here, but I want to first start with just some general concerns and just outside recommendations that I think might be helpful in this situation. I know that, Trevor has the EBD and ASD diagnoses. I also, from what I understand, there were no medications, and I'm not necessarily going to advocate for medications. What I am going to say is I would definitely suggest, you know, going in for an updated psychiatric evaluation and getting him assessed to see if there is some kind of additional assistance that he can get to kind of help him with those things from a psychiatrist's point of view, and help with the medical side of things, just to kind of soften the intensity of the emotions and feelings that he might be feeling. But again, I'm here as a behavioral consultant, but just as an observer in these types of cases, this level of sensitivity and this extremity, and given some of his background and trauma history, it might be helpful to consult with a psychiatrist as well. If that's not in the current picture. The other thing I would say is, without being able to really observe what's going on with him, I'm really remiss to provide too many adjustments to what's going on. I'm going to make just some simple recommendations and for some slight adjustments that I think might be helpful. They are probably going to put a little extra pressure on the school, so it might be good to, Percy, I would say, really get with the principal and see if some of these things can be accommodated, especially it's logistically probably going to be a little bit different. But I have a couple different observations. First and foremost, I would say the number one thing that jumps out at me is the disparity between his skill set and the kids in his classroom. I think there's an obvious balance to be struck between him being so disruptive in a gen ed classroom because he's just talking continuously versus him being in a special education classroom, but in a room where the skill deficits are so broad that might creating some of the conditions of stigmatization that comes with that, especially if kids that are very acutely aware of the situation and surroundings around them. So if is any way that maybe my suggestion would be, I'm sorry, Chris, give me 1 second to get this out, and I'd love to hear what you have to say. My suggestion would be, since Chris is already logistically or functionally as a one-on-one, my suggestion would be to try to slowly reintegrate some gen ed opportunities for him to start participating in those classrooms. From what I understand, he likes science. So I'd actually maybe start looking to do some push-ins in science class to start putting him around other peers so that he's doing the same stuff. He's doing something he likes. So we're kind of preemptively controlling for some of the likelihood of the vocalizations and the suicidal threats. I actually don't even want to call them suicidal threats. I'm going to call them self-harm for now. Self-harm vocalizations or verbalizations. That would be one thing I would really suggest, just to kind of make that subtle adjustment. And then over time, maybe every week or so, maybe every 3, 4, 5 days, adding another class and really trying to build that up to where he can have a transition out there and like an actual clear pathway to reintegrate. The second thing I would say is he's saying some pretty, there's some acute phrases that everyone keeps giving me in the way that they're describing his behavior that leads me to think that there's more than meets the eye in terms of why he's saying what he's saying. I'm not completely convinced. Now, again, they did do a 72-hour hold, so that's a red flag that I would want to revisit. Maybe we should look at the paperwork a little more closely, but given on the one hand, Mom's complete dismissal of the situation. And I think that, Rebecca, I think you just don't think it's a real, you really don't think he's really going to hurt himself.
No,
he doesn't have access. Does he have access to that kind of stuff in your house?
Our house is just a normal house and he's never shown.
So the kitchen knives are out there. The cutting boards are out there. Everything. Okay. If I were to ask you temporarily, just as a precaution, to put those things away just so we can really try to target this without in a different way than we have been.
If he was actually using those things while at the house to do this, then sure, but he's not. I don't need to change what I'm doing at home. He's not harming himself.
And here's what I'm saying. I actually agree with you. I totally hear what you're saying. Let me finish my hypothesis about what I think is going on, and then we'll circle back, and I hope that maybe I can get your agreement then. So this is what I think is going on. I think the bottom line is that what everyone keeps saying is that it's about his common interests, specifically getting everyone to focus on what he wants to talk about, when he wants to talk about, because he's really bored in class, doesn't like what he's doing, not interested in what he's doing, and also expressly not interested in communicating effectively in terms of appropriately with his peers, because he actually doesn't see them as his peers. He sees them as different tier than where he's at socially and intellectually. Okay. The other thing is that someone explicitly said, and I quote, he feeds off of how we react to the situations. I believe that's actually Chris and Amy, you both said that, in that he says the thing that he's saying, and it's almost like you can tell that part of the fun of the situation is that you guys are really responding and attending to his needs and really bringing that, you know, hyper awareness to the threat and that, et cetera. Now, that's not to diminish the reality of a possibility of a particular threat, but that's simply to point out that if we are to assume that there's a validity to the threat, but on the other side of it, we also can observe an obvious degree of satisfaction being gained from the general chaos creation and reactivity that happens as a result of it, then we need to control for both. Which means we probably going to need to institute a lot higher threshold in terms of what it takes for us to pull work away from him, reattend for what he wants with those activities and common interests that he wants to talk about. And also, honestly, Percy, I would say what it takes for you to come into the room and talk to him. My suggestion would be, because Chris, you said that he's on an NCR, I would actually remove the end and actually put in some kind of a contingency in place to where he has unfettered access to you just being there next to him, because that's your job, to be in the classroom and be around him. But leveraging the fact that he wants your attention, he wants your social interaction, he wants you to just, you know, be his buddy and talk about the 90s and Nirvana and all that stuff. Okay. But make it conditional and contingent on him participating in some activities for brief periods of time. And then if he does begin to, you know, escalate or all those things, kind of like withdrawing that attention, but staying close and present so that you can protect against the likelihood of self-harm. Does that make sense?
It does, but I disagree with the approach.
Okay.
I do know that you shouldn't have kids talking about self-harm at school.
I hear you. Yeah.
I do what I got to do on a daily basis.
Yeah. It also sounds like you're kind of, if we're limiting attention in response to suicidal ideation, it sounds like we're inviting him to amp up his behavior. And
I think we need to figure out the validity of the situation. I think if you're playing excessive amounts of prevent, you're potentially feeding into the fact that, I mean, here's what I see. I see that there has never been an attempt. Mom, he's been doing it for a couple years and it's on the onset of acute trauma situation. Sure. But really more acute event of separation, which I don't want to even go into the trauma aspect of it, because even though it may have been traumatic, it's not expressing itself as a trauma response. It's expressing itself as a specific social response in facilitating other people's behavior around him and orchestrating the way that they react based on how he can, based on his desires, given the immediate circumstances around him. So what I would actually, if I were to like tag or tact a function to it, And again, I haven't done a functional analysis. This is just from my observations of my interviews with you guys. So, I mean, the experimental analysis might have a different result, but just on its face, I would call it escape to signs of damage, or escape from work to signs of damage. And what I mean by that is this like shifting multiply controlled behavior where it may begin as escape from work, or it may begin as a denial of access to a person's attention. But once that initiating function is met, then it shifts to being maintained over time to watching everybody dance. Dance to his words, dance to his whims, dance to the threats and fear and concern that you express for him because of the seriousness of the words that he's expressing. So now, whether or not that's true or not, sure, I could be wrong. But what I would say is, until we can actually have the evidence, and until we can actually conduct a reasonable assessment of what's going on the ground, and especially given the fact that he's gone through a 72-hour hold, he has not been medicated by psychiatrists when he did go there, and he hasn't had another incident like that since, nor has he been held, and he's had CPS at his doorstep countless times, I think it's reasonable to assume that the severity and credibility of the threats might be overstated.
And I just don't want it to push to a place like, okay, but if it's self-harm, if it's suicidal ideation, and he pushes past it because you've mentioned that he's able to manipulate, right? He's able to shift people's perspectives and try to control people's responses. You said it right now, but do you think that it could push to a place where, if we call his bluff, he's pushing to a place where he's going to hurt himself, and then now it's a way different ballgame.
And that's
why would
I'm
that happen
too?
At I mean, school and not at home?
Why would he push himself?
Why would I call his bluff all the time at home? It's not happening.
I mean, that's at home. There's no demands. I mean, there he does some stuff around the house, I'm sure, from what he says. But isn't it like he's at home? He's in his
it's
happy
the
place.
Weekend.
And this is another. This is what I would say too. And I don't think that we should eliminate his sessions with you, Percy. I think that the curriculum that you're using makes total sense. I think addressing that in a systematic way is a necessity. Building those coping skills is a requirement for what we need to deal with. However, what I would say is that maybe if we just tampered down on the reactivity and put it on a more typical structured weekly, bi-weekly, or at least a fixed meeting time so that he's not controlling the terms of your social interactions or of your sessions, but he's becoming now a participant in them. That might give us a better read over whether or not that's actually why it's happening or not. Because right now the read is off. Like, there's no way to really make a determination here. There's really no way to effectively intervene unless we make a decision to steer this one way or the other. Like, at some point, something's going to have to give. Because if right now what I see is everybody walking on eggshells around him and everybody being hyper fixated on the words that he's using, despite a 72-hour hold that did not result in anything, a ongoing removal from peers that is not at this point in time yielding the possibility, or at least expressing the possibility, of him being able to reintegrate into the mainstream situation, and also potentially exaggerating things because it's creating this ongoing back and forth dynamic to where if he doesn't want what's going on, or he doesn't like what's going on, or he doesn't want to do what he's being asked to do, he can simply pull the fire alarm and get everybody to run. So we need to get to the point where we can tell the difference between yelling fire in a crowded movie theater versus actually being on fire. Now, do we run the risk of this potentially deteriorating? Yes. I mean, absolutely, there's risk to these things. And that's why with mom being here, we need to have this conversation. We need to have her informed consent and willingness to participate in the process. And actually, this is a really great opportunity for me to go back to the original discussion that I was trying to bring up to you before, Becca, in that in order for everyone to feel comfortable with something like this, we need to maximize his safety and minimize the possibility of his ability to follow through should we be pushing this in a way where it happens. So everyone feels safe about being able to push the threshold of this thing and try to get some control over it. It would just really help out if you would do that just for the short time being, let's just say a month or two, so we can really test things out and get a feeling for what's going on. And if we're totally wrong and it's fine, it'll be fine and you can go back to normal. But if we're totally wrong the other way, we've minimized his opportunity and access to be able to follow through. And then we can medically intervene in that point in time and have a more crisis-oriented approach. But right now, I don't necessarily see crisis. I just see the potential for crisis. And we're making decisions based on the potential for crisis, which is important in the short term. But in the long term, we can't just keep coming from this reactive perspective. At some point, we have to make a decision to do something to start solving the problem. And that's my perspective and my point of view that I wanted to express. So, Rebecca, with hearing me now give that rationale, would you be willing to kind of help Chris and Percy feel comfortable in stepping out of their comfort zones to help push him to try to solve this problem by doing that for them?
It's not going to make a difference. I'll put the knives away. I'll put the stuff away. But I'm telling you, he's going to be okay. And if you guys want to bring a psychiatrist on board to confirm that, I'm all for that. You guys do that. But yeah, I'll put the stuff away.
Awesome. Well, hey, I have a moral objection
to what you're asking me to do.
Okay, Chris, what's your moral objection?
I mean, I can't in good conscience sit in a room while a kid's talking to me about killing himself.
Okay. Well, what is your suggestion?
He gets his work done. I guess he needs to get his work done. He'll get his work done really quick. Maybe it's not all of the work that he could be assigned in a general ed class, but he gets it done.
So he gets the modified work done.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he modified it based on his need.
You did?
I mean, his teacher did. Amy's great.
She did?
Yeah.
It's not what Amy said. Amy said she doesn't belong in his class in that classroom. Amy said that he belongs in general ed, but he can't because he keeps talking, so that's not the right room for him. Amy also said that the overall work that he has is still inadequate for where he's at because he can get through it so fast. So my question to you is that, do you have a moral objection to giving someone a diminished workload that is not equivalent to peers despite their capacity to do so, which in the long run is going to result in their inability to continually escalate and build necessary skills so that they can achieve the academic progress required to get a diploma and then potentially get a job and or attend college in the future, because that's the reality that we're facing right now. So the decision that we have here is we can continue to mollify and placate the behavior based on what we currently know, or we can confront the situation head on, do what's uncomfortable for us but might be necessary for him, see where it takes us and see what we can understand and glean from it, and then make adjustments from there. Because I want to be very clear about another thing too, is that this isn't that we're not longer taking it seriously that he's making these threats. It's more like, how are we going to respond to what he's doing with those threats? Is that, are we going to provide him with, and again, I'm going to use this phrase, and this is hyperbolic, but I'm just trying to express a point of view, so please just accept it at face value. The circus and the orchestrating that he gets to do as a result, where adults are tap dancing at his wands and waves, or are we going to internalize what he's saying, document it, note it, make the external referrals that we need to, make the appropriate reports that we need to both the family, the doctor, even the CPS worker that might be working on his ongoing case, the principal, and monitor that without him being aware of the attention that we're paying to it so that we can effectively intervene. Now, I understand a moral objection in terms of if we weren't doing anything about it. I hear you on that. I'm not saying we're not going to do anything about it. I'm saying we're not going to let him know what we're doing about it, because him knowing what we're doing about it is allowing him to potentially exaggerate a little bit what he actually means and exactly how he's acting. So I can appreciate moral objections to those things, because in schools, it's very common, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, do no evil, right? That's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying hear evil, see evil, do something about evil. Don't advertise what you're doing, especially to the person who might be using it as a way to overstate reality and what they're really willing to do to themselves.
I mean, I just think Trevor needs a friend. I've been that friend for him.
And we want you to, and I don't want you to stop in the long run. And Chris, I don't want you to stop being his friend. Actually, that's where you come into play, and why I actually want you to be the one-on-one person taken around the building. I think it's time that you, as a friend, get him out of that room and start teaching him how to make friends his own age. How's that? How about you be the friend that facilitates other friends? How about you become a gateway to friends? Instead of just being the singular source of point of contact of the feeling or the hole that gets filled by his lack of friendships.
I think we're going to need to find a middle spot. And actually, if I can interrupt, I was hesitant when we were shutting it down. I want him. I like that you said he can have scheduled access. We can still have our sessions. We can still work on some things. I'm curious if you can dig into what it's going to look like if we do see it escalate, and what our criteria would be for if we had to do a removal, we kind of need to know the go signs. If we're not paying attention to it, we're not feeding into it. We need to know when.
I would say physical signs of escalation, actual physical signs. I mean, the words are definitely a problem. I'm not going to pretend like the words aren't a problem, right? But there is a difference between yelling fire and being on fire. And I would say escalations towards action and any indicators of action should change the discussion and the conversation. But should there be escalation towards overt action, at that point, that should trigger a crisis criteria. And I think that we can sit down and work out the details in terms of what everyone's comfort level of what would trigger crisis criteria. But then that would be, let's get medical personnel involved. Let's get a hospital on board. Let's get ready to make some, very clear targeted interventions where he can go in and get much more acute treatment to deal with that. That is not just general day-to-day in school. Medical treatment. Psychiatric treatment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I'm curious what those results will be, and I think that might look like a collaboration once we have a little bit more of that information, or we can check the box if we've at least done that and seeing.
And that's all I'm asking for here. And thank you for that, Percy. That's all I'm asking for here. What I'm asking for here is let's actually try this and see where it is. If it confirms the other way, we definitely need to adjust. I don't think that we just kamikaze ride this. I think we need more information, and we're not going to get that information unless we adjust our tactics. And I think this is the kind of tactic that'll really give us the answers we want one way or another, so we can really make a definitive decision when the time comes.
Okay.
Well, thank you. So Rebecca, if you don't mind maybe dropping us an email when you've had the opportunity to put everything up in the house and stuff. And then we'll sit down and really hammer out those crisis criteria of escalation so we can have a very clear understanding of what it looks like if it does switch from just words to much more identifiable, credible threat, and what are the steps that will follow to secure his safety. And then we'll kind of go from there. And why don't we just set up like a 30-day standing meeting to just follow up and review kind of where we are. Does that seem amenable?
Yeah, we can do that.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate it. Okay, folks. I will stick around and let's do that. And Rebecca, thank you for your time.
All right, time to break character and switch this over to a traditional conversational podcast.
I mean, starting from the top, I love the initial medical psych eval. Let's make sure we have a strong medical basis before we start looking at manipulating environmental variables and specific contingencies for this individual. I think that self-harm vocalizations and threats, while that is like the challenging topic here, is something that can get a consistent response. I don't know. That could be a scary thing to dive down into, but this resembles cases. This resembles cases.
Yeah, hold on. But Dave, go down that road a little bit, because I think it's coming from me, and the confidence that I would exude in that scenario makes it sound like it's definitive that I'm saying that or whatever. But like from your point of view and your experience,
sure.
I mean, is that response like you were already starting to pull on that thread? So walk us through that a little more.
So I think that when you go in, you do an evaluation, if I get called into a classroom, I'm sitting there, I might look at how adults respond to the behavior. And I might use tools that are trademarked, the Beacon Consequence Analysis Forum that I really like, that's free online. We can cut that part out. But I use tools that I enjoy that talk about how adults consistently respond. And when we look at the behavior and just the consistent patterns, whether or not the words themselves have validity, which you have to dig into that piece as well, we also have to look at patterns of behavior and consistent responses to look for maintaining variables and reinforcing variables. So it's just a question that everyone might be doing their part correctly from all of their perspectives. But we can dig a little bit deeper into it to suss out the validity of the language. And I think that at least keeping an eye or understanding that there may be this note that, yep, we're consistently leaving class. We're consistently going and talking about preferred topics and activities with people we really like. We have to look at that kind of around whatever B happens to be right there. And it just so happened that B within the equation was self-harm tacting or threats of self-harm.
I don't think I could have said it better. I agree with you completely. I mean, Danielle, do you have any commentary on that?
Well, I was just going to say there are suicide assessment tools that people can use, right, to more definitively say, like, in the meantime, while we're waiting for more mental health support, this risk is very low despite the vocalizations, right? There's no plan that's been discussed. Exactly. There's been no actual attempts. There's none of the signs, right? There are the risk assessments and there are trainings that can be done. Is that the assessment you were referring to, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, as a behavior analyst, trying to improv and riff about different specific, I'm sure, marketed and trademarked threat assessments that I just didn't have the names. And that would have been a nice list to have on monitor number two.
It's called fair use, buddy. You're allowed to talk about that.
But no,
we have show notes, man. We'll have
that's true. But those are the pieces. Those are the assessments or the things that the tools that you can use that are research supported, not us potentially, but someone within that domain to determine the validity of those suicidal statements.
Well, and we can get the initial, the basic assessment training for suicide risk as well. Like that's a commonly offered, it's a first level, like the initial, is there any immediate risk right now?
Yeah, my thing with suicidality is it's all about means, opportunity, previous attempts. I mean, those are the things that it's about immediacy, right? I mean, because we can only assess that. And also there's a certain, whether or not we want to admit it or not for school-aged children, there's a social validity piece here that matters, and that parents are primary decision makers. And in this case, Children's Services was already involved, so mandated reporting had happened. And not to mention, he had already been on a 72-hour hold in the past. So he had been under medical care for this and released. And if you come out unmedicated and no further action or recommendations, I mean, that's usually a sign that they're not too worried about it anymore. But again, there was enough factors at play and enough things going on contextually where it just didn't make sense to really hyper-focus on that.
We were prepared, or I was prepared, to take the perspective of kind of skirting around extinction. And I think you said it without saying, of drying up that source of reinforcement. And I was prepared with my perspective to be opposed to that, because that within the language right now is kind of people are anti.
Oh, you thought I was going to say, we're going to apply an extinction procedure. And then you're like, we don't do extinction here.
And then I was going to be like, I know what an extinction burst is. I'm over it.
I mean, look, man. Go ahead. What?
I said, I was about to do the same thing. Stand up. Like, we don't like your ABA kind around here.
Yeah, get your ABAing out of here. We don't do that here. Oh, man. That conversation is a totally different conversational topic. I just do not understand the aversion to extinction. I can never, it will never resonate with me, and it will never compute rationally. It's a natural byproduct of environmental contact with contingencies. Like you are under the conditions of extinction throughout your day very regularly. I mean, and that's that. Like, so to say that you don't apply systematic extinction, I don't know if that's logical. I don't know. You can't necessarily always outcompete stuff.
But Chris has been in the field for 10 months, so
I know.
He said a couple buzzwords and
he's a passionate sycophant right now. He's that's right.
I mean, Chris is representative. Though, that character is representative of a lot of my own personal work right now, man. Like in schools and stuff, I work with a lot of people who have a lot of strong opinions with no experience, formal education, or actually informed point of view other than their beliefs and moral standing, which.
But also people who work with the clients one-on-one every day or on the floor, like get to know them really well.
I hear you.
They have some valuable input. It's just they don't have the knowledge you have to put the two worlds together.
They have valuable input. They don't have analytical.
They're not going to be able to develop the strategies analytical and plans.
Point of view or strategy. Yeah, strategic planning and, you know, decision making. So, yes, I'm not diminishing their opinions in terms of like what they're bringing to the table. But sometimes it does get overbearing in terms of what they think is going on in the reality situation. And honestly, in a situation like this, for example, the way I read Chris as a character, I read him as a guy who's super, because he's so new, he's done the first cardinal sin that I did with my first client, fell in love with them. And when you overstep that professional boundary into taking it personal and getting emotionally vested that degree into the person you're serving, it clouds your judgment, you know, just like it does for the parents. And, you know, I always say this actually to my supervisees and usually new people. I was like, you get one or two, you fall in love with the first one or two in that way. And you have to learn the hard lessons that come with being overtly emotionally involved in those cases. Cause you learn a lot about how much it diminishes your capacity to make objective recommendations and objective decisions and see things for what they are rather than what you hope or want them to be. You know, it comes off later in life or later in your career, like with me, where it comes off cold and, you know, calculated and dismissive. But I mean, that's a thing that personally I feel like I've trained myself at this point to do, because otherwise you can't do your job to the best of your ability, which sounds counterintuitive, you know, at least for me.
It allows you to take a step back. I've definitely seen myself kind of cross that threshold over the years where it's like, I was actually talking about the BACB code of ethics a couple of weeks ago and and thinking about how it's not just for the client. It's for us as practitioners too, like dual relationships. If you get in there and it gets dicey and you get invested in this kid, you lose touch with it.
Yeah, man. I mean, cause signs of damage in particular is a tough function to want to come to terms in and make a regular. Like that's basically saying someone is reinforced by watching other people tap dance and I'm not going to say suffer necessarily, but show emotional discomfort, right?
Well, contingencies around adults too, like it is rewarding for you to be able to be the person that turns off a behavior consistently. And while you might be making those proactive approaches, you get to be that person, and that adult is entering the situation and is continually negatively reinforced for their behaviors because they get to push the behavior away. Sometimes an outward perspective is kind of what it can take to identify those maintaining variables, because I'm sure I'm sure Percy had the best intentions going into this and was trying to connect and trying to get the kid back down to calm. But you have to look at, they got to become that person. They were kind of neglecting some other clients and always here. They were always here when it needed to happen, and they got to be that person. So that's just constant reinforcement for being that person to talk the kid off the ledge.
Dude, that is facts. That is another one with these kinds of situations where that hero complex is a big common. It's a problem. Like it is a common thing that you run into and you have to navigate. And how do you sensitively basically clamp down on that and put the kibosh, because you have to, because it's a problem, while also not diminishing that it's coming from a good place and it's coming from a caring, compassionate, empathetic place.
Absolutely.
It's tough. Yeah, that's a great point.
Dimitri, you had mentioned the trauma response versus an emotional response. How do you categorize those? Can you just like break down your thinking a little bit more there? I think I get where you're going there.
Look, man, trauma response to me means an acute reactive response. Okay. It's operantly conditioned respondent-like behavior. Okay. So I mean, like it's occurred as a response to environmental variables, but it triggers an instantaneous stimulus control way like you would a US that becomes a CS. All right. So that's my view of trauma from a behavioral point of view is it's classical conditioning of heightened nervous system state, whatever that is. Anything other than that is reactive emotionality, and it is problematic in terms of, and it is difficult for the person experientially, but to necessarily classify it as like an overt trauma response that you need to be hypersensitive around or that you can't necessarily program to, I think is it's just not right. It's an erroneous conceptualization of what you're looking at. It's an incorrect classification of the behavior, and it changes the way that you should treat it and place it into your puzzle. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I don't have anything to add. I was just looking to like learn that perspective there. Yeah.
Yeah, because I just think about it like when I think about a trauma response, I think of like post-traumatic stress disorder, like. You know, like a somebody who it doesn't, this is an exaggerated response result, right? Because I mean, like there's actually been, I can't remember the study, but there was a study they came across that actually people that work in psychiatric facilities experience the same degree of post-traumatic stress response as combat veterans. And I can't remember, it's very old. It's like 10 years ago I came across that. I don't remember the study, but it's something that had stuck with me forever. Because it changed the way that I viewed what a trauma response was in terms of like emotional impact and the degree of control that it has on your actual nervous system. And I can say this even for myself. Like I went through a period of time early on in my career when I was a BT where like, I mean, I'm 6'3", you know, 280-pound dude, like, and I lift weights. So like they put me with heavy hitters back then and I got physically abused. 6-7 hours a day every day for a long time. 7-8 years. And that there's a stickiness to that ongoing continual exposure to the constant threat of injury and suffering and pain that changes the way that you are on edge and just reactive, right? It's just it's autonomic, right? It's like it's you don't even thinking about it because of the type of stimulus control that's being exerted on you. I mean, for example, I had at one point in time in my career, you know, when I discovered disc golfing, which was my opportunity to get out in the woods and be by myself for a couple hours after work because I just needed quietude. I mean, I worked with a kid that he was two people on one. It was constant physical aggression, 6-7 hours a day, and us attempting to just redirect him. And I mean, he hurt me in ways that I can't even like almost rip my genitals off, not exaggerating, like bit my muscle off of my bone on my arm. Like, I mean, he hurt me, broke a finger. I mean, he hurt me. He also would scream this blood curdling scream that is like literally out of a horror movie. We were tracking it on a clicker for the first 3 months we were working with him over it was like 900. The average, I think, was 976 or something. It was like an unbelievable amount of blood curdling screams for the day where you would think that he would lose his voice. And the screams stuck with me so much is that when I would hear him screaming in the woods some days when I was out there by myself. So, I mean, this stuff is sticky, right? That's what I think of like what a trauma response is the stickiness, you know, those, this respondent autonomic nervous system, heightened nervous system responding that simulates like what you would see in someone who was classically conditioned, not just, you know, direct tacted vocalizations relating to something terrible that happened. And again, that's not to diminish those experiences or to diminish, you know, what those, the impact or why that person is doing what they're doing. But that's just to distinguish between, you know, when we're talking about what a thing is with trauma versus what a thing is an emotional response relative to certain circumstances.
Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me revise that. Marvelous.
Marvelous.
Marvelous. I love Marvelous. I miss Marvelous.
Anything else we wanted to cover? Are we good?
Signs of damage.
You want to talk about signs of damage?
Well, just a little more information about it.
You do some Jack Michael. You've been around some signs of damage. I can think of one or two specific characters that you might have some experience with. Just what's your take? Like, because here's the thing. You know what's funny is I've been helping my sister study for her RBT, and she passed her test and whatever. Like, I'm not her supervisor for the world out there, but I still helped her. She did in her practice RBT exam, there was a question where is control a function? And it was wrong because it's not, you know, whatever, one of the isolated functions. But yeah. I mean, like, there's only four things. And there's no combinations of those things.
Only one at a time.
One at a time. In a vacuum.
That's right. That's right. And it's not and no one is reinforced by people are only reinforced by people's attention directly. They're not reinforced by playing them like puppets on strings. That is not. Controlling other human beings is not a function of behavior. Oh, man. Anyway, go ahead. What are you thinking?
I've got a client recently that I've been working with who is, I've had to kind of give some pep talks to the staff about the signs of damage component. I think to people new in the field, neutrality is kind of a strange concept when it comes to responding to, especially that level of, and that level of personal attack that comes
and
with
being able
of damage.
To exercise neutrality too, like in understanding that minor facial tics matter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The discipline and self-control of your facial muscles. It's an art. It's an Olympic sport.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, teaching that neutrality is a pretty hard skill.
How have they responded to a description of signs of damage? Do you ever worry that teaching somebody or talking about signs of in general as a function? And just for listeners talking about, we're talking about signs of. Jack Michael theorized a variety of different ways that you can, the reinforcers occur to as a signs of. So like a seeing the signs of something being that reinforcer, signs of damage, signs of whatever, capitulation, signs of. And it's really more of like a, I use it, or I specifically categorize it as a subcategory of social reinforcers. So it's not just any old attention, but it's specifically the disappointment or like the evoking of a negative response or a negative emotional reaction from another person.
Dude, it's everywhere. I mean, but let's be honest, like, it's hard to make an impact in the world now. You can make a TikTok
internet
account.
Trolls are signs
you
of
can
damage.
Make a, you can make it an internet account where you wash a MacBook in a sink and you, outside of monetization from views, you get 8 million comments. Like, it is, you're right, internet trolls. Like, it is so, we are so deprived. The MO is so strong to have an impact on people. And it's so much easier to come in and order a large Coke and a McDonald's than throw it back at those people for views. Like, what are you gaining? You are gaining impact. Like, it's so let's get out of the special ed room. Let's get out of this right now. Like, yeah, this is it's everywhere and it's devastating. Personally.
Oh, signs of damage. The internet is a walk. It's the vast ocean of signs of damage. Of function of welcome to Twitter.
It's the billboard of damage. Yes, correct.
Yeah. I mean, signs of damage also, though, is a hard pill to swallow for people because they don't want to characterize children as, you know, they like that is very easily mistranslated as manipulative, right? And I even use that, but I use that language not to label a person as a manipulator, but to use simple language to drag out what people are actually saying, right? If they perceive it as manipulation, then maybe that gives you insight into the function of the kind of attention they're seeking. Because again, like just like all tangibles aren't equal, right? A toy versus a collectible versus $1 million versus a Lambo, You can't tell me that those are all just tangibles. No, they're different degrees of things. Just like all attention is the same thing. Like there's different degrees, different categories and subcategories of attention, and being able to microanalyze, or at least slowly start paring down and isolating what kind of funnel someone's looking at to feed themselves. Like that really helps you effectively characterize what you're looking at. And it's still behavioral, because we're still talking about satiation and deprivation and what satisfaction a person is gaining from contacting a particular reinforcer. It's just tacting it down effectively so that you can get a much more accurate description of what you're looking at. Yeah, signs of damage it's a tough one. Anyone with those EBD or those emotional disturbances in schools, or like those emotional disorders, personality disorders, mood disorders, anything involving borderline personalities, like, oh my goodness. I mean, signs of damage is present and effervescent. And especially with, like, for example, the suicidal ideation stuff, where it's like, if it's verbal junk, that's an automatic, like, oh, we might want to at least think about signs of damage. And that's why when I was talking to Percy, I was asking about malingering, right? Because it's like, am I exaggerating and lying in my sessions to garner sympathy? And then when I am garnering that sympathy, am I then using that person's sympathy towards me in a way to get them to be overtly reactive to my needs when I start expressing these verbal statements of self-harm?
And that made Percy a little self-conscious.
It sure did, right? Did you get worked? Holy shit.
Like me? Yeah.
Yeah. I got worked. And like, yeah, sometimes you're getting worked.
Yeah. I think with the signs of damage also, like when you kind of allow these little pockets of like what got to you,
I know.
The individual learns how to kind of keep plowing through that way. Like I had a kid call me Baldy once. And it is one of the few times where I was like, oh man, that would really fucking hurt. Like, he got me.
Oh man, I know, man. Dude, I've had a couple get to me recently where it's like, man, that was a knife cut deep.
Yeah. How do you know?
Anyway.
You in my head?
So yeah, that's signs of damage.
Your code word, if you're interested in earning BACBCUs, is signs of damage. Again, your code word is signs of damage if you're interested in earning BACBCUs. Head over to explanatoryfiction.com, purchase the quiz, complete the quiz, and then your CUs are sent to you automatically. Again, your code word is signs of damage if you're interested in earning BACBCUs. The views expressed during the Explanatory Fiction podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the official policy or position of any other agency, organization, employer, or company. Assumptions made in the analysis are not reflective of any position of any other entity other than the authors, and since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to revision, change, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity. This podcast is to educate and inform, provide discussion, and does not constitute professional advice. Remember again that the variables in this case were randomly generated, as well as the name and the episode imagery. Thank you, math. Thank you, science. And thank you, artificial intelligence. Rhino LLC is an approved continuing education provider that is ACE number hashtag OP-19-3037, and the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, also known as the BACB, a registered trademark, does not sponsor or approve or endorse Rhino LLC, the materials, information, or sessions identified herein. Thank you for listening.